Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Edward France, who is a presidential historian who teaches at the University of Indianapolis. He has written widely on how the American presidency has changed in the last two centuries. And his latest book, The Door of Hope, Republican Presidents and the First Southern Strategy, is just out in paperback. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edward France.
Ian, thank you for having me.
And on Monday, the Republican National Committee released an autopsy report, and it's called Growth and Opportunity Project. And it basically, I guess the headlines are that it describes the Republican Party as having a party that is scary, narrow-minded, out of touch, and that we're a party of stuffy old men. Those are the headlines, but it seems to me that there's a lot of deeper reasons, which I'd like to go into with you. But what's your sense of this reckoning, this soul-searching that's going on?
Well, I think there's still very much a question of which direction the party might go, which of many directions. And at least, you know, you have the kind of the Rand Paul types with the libertarian angle, and then you get some of these others, the Reince Priebuses, and then you get the Karl Rove types, and all of whom are trying to call themselves true Republicans. And I think their real problem is that they're also trying to define both Republicanism and conservatism simultaneously. I think that gets them in a lot of trouble.
So what does Republicanism mean today?
That is a question that they would be better able to answer, because it means so many different things depending on where you are. Certainly looking at what, say, Ted Cruz, who was giving the keynote at CPAC, was saying, it still means very limited government and fiscal responsibility. Beyond that, there are so many different iterations, it's a little bit hard to figure out exactly how the party wants to brand itself with a simple, pithy answer to a question that should be straightforward, I think.
But isn't there a huge contradiction, and indeed it could end up splitting the party, when you've got people like Rand Paul, who won the straw poll at CPAC, as his father had done previously,
right,
where he's basically saying, we're out of touch, we're covered in moss. And he's, on the one hand, has the same message as Ted Cruz on limited government, but on the other hand, he's basically saying he has the opposite attitude to most traditional Republicans on all the social issues and on some important foreign policy issues like the war on drugs and war in general.
Yes. I mean, I think from what I saw from headlines, and again, I didn't get to see the entirety of the Priebus sort of state of the RNC, but on the headlines, it made it look as if he's saying we need to go beyond being the party of Reagan as well. And I mean, I think the Republican Party has been able to paper over some real differences by being united on social issues heretofore, which they seem to have less consensus about than at any time in most people's recent memory. And the quote that I didn't see attributed to the person I would think one would want to identify with if one were a Republican, I didn't see a lot of talk of with malice toward none and charity for all, evoking Abraham Lincoln and evoking the party of Lincoln. And I would think that would be a way to make an appeal that could get them in a direction that, for those who want to go in that way, get them in a direction that would be more appealing.
Well, but that contradicts, doesn't it, Edward France? It contradicts your book, The Door of Hope, Republican Presidents and the First Southern Strategy, in as much as the Republican Party has become a Southern party, and President Lincoln is an anathema to the Southerners.
Well, the interesting thing with Lincoln himself is, of course, in the 19th century, you got a number of Southerners saying, if only he had lived, he would have been more sympathetic to us. And I think, as much as my book describes a process in which the Republican Party distanced itself from African Americans, what I found in the period from the end of Reconstruction in 1877, really through 1933, that the Republican Party was of two minds. And some could take a very cynical read on what presidents did when they went to the South during that time period, which was basically gesture towards the legacy of the Republican Party when it came to what I call the legacy of liberation stemming from the Civil War, while also making efforts to reach out to the white South. But I would argue, Ian, that they were, especially early on, whether it was Rutherford B. Hayes or somebody like Benjamin Harrison, to extent William McKinley, that they honestly thought that they could do both, that there was room for both within the Republican Party. That is, for African Americans, white Southerners, as well as Northern Republicans, to all belong to the same party. That didn't happen. But what I'm struck by is, in that time period, there was still this idea that the party had to acknowledge its past. And it was an expansive past, a time when the Republican Party was not the party of limited government, but quite the opposite. That's the real history of the Republican Party. It's not a party of limited government. If you talk about when the Republican Party came into power and what it did, it was a party of expansive government. So that's the part that I find fascinating.
Again, I'm speaking with Edward France, who's a presidential historian who teaches at the University of Indianapolis. He has written widely on how the American presidency has changed in the last two centuries, and his latest book is The Door of Hope, Republican Presidents and the First Southern Strategy, now out in paperback. And we're talking about Monday's release of the RNC's, the Republican National Committee's report, Growth and Opportunity Project, which is an autopsy on where the party stands and how it's going to find a way to win back the presidency. One of the things, of course, they've offered up in this report is a $10 million minority outreach program to promote the GOP brand in local communities. Again, this feels to me kind of like a corporate approach. You know, if an oil company has a spill, their first priority is not necessarily to clean up the spill, but to go on television and tell everybody how much they care about the environment. And I feel like so much of what they're talking about here is a public relations way around some deep and inherent problems.
I agree with you. You know, I think traditionally when Republicans would talk about minority outreach, that would be something that was specifically African-American, and they spent years courting the likes of J.C. Watt, Michael Steele, Kenneth Blackwell of Ohio, who was always looked at as the key black conservative. I think that was part of the appeal of Herman Cain. But those folks are really few and far between. And I think they're trying to make that pivot towards Latinos, Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio being foremost among them. But I agree with you. It's a little hard to just point to the people who are at the top of the pyramid and tell the average person that we've got plenty of room for people just like you, especially on local government. And keeping in mind that I'm also here in Indiana. I'm not in the South. I'm not in some other places. But it's hard for the Republican Party in this state, for instance, or any of the neighboring states, to really point to meaningful minority outreach to any minority where they're really like they've got kind of young, active party members who are Latino, who are African American, who are going to make the appeals that they're interested in doing. So, yeah, it's interesting to see how that $10 million, how it would be spent, isn't it?
Well, I think, though, that when you consider the deep doctrinal differences at the heart of the Republican Party, which are, I think, similar to what's going on in the Vatican between the hierarchy and particularly the nuns, there's a similar situation here, which we've talked about, how the Rand Pauls and the Libertarian wing, which is growing, and I think it's the only part of the party that's growing, particularly attracting young Republicans, how it completely takes the opposite tack on almost all the social issues, which are really the red lines for social conservatives in the Republican Party. And then within that battle, you've got the other battle that you alluded to between Karl Rove and Sarah Palin and Rush Limbaugh, the entertainment talk show wing, if you will, of the Republican Party. And it's hard to know who's up and who's down. I know who's got the biggest megaphone.
Right. That's why they're already looking to 2016. It's just so hard to see who ends up being the standard bearer and in what direction that takes the party, because I think most observers who've seen more of Paul Ryan don't think that that's quite ready to go presidential just yet, although he would certainly like to. And so there's not a clear sense of leadership. I think you're right about that. And there are a lot of shouters, as you said, who have a lot of influence, but they're not going to be the standard bearers for the party. And it always is a little bit awkward when you have somebody who's hardly conservative in almost any definition of the word, like Donald Trump, being invited to your events and excluding other Republicans because they're not conservative. That just speaks to me as being a recipe for disaster, at least short term.
But in terms of what Republicans believe today and what their core beliefs, leaving aside principles, that's where I find it quite alarming. And Jeb Bush at CPAC alluded to this when he said we're anti-everything, including anti-science, which I think was an important statement to make. The nature of so much of that party that is anti-science, so vehemently anti-Obama, based upon insanities like the Bertha conspiracy, that he's a Kenyan Muslim in disguise, the creationism, most of these beliefs, I think, are shared by the same group. I'm not sure how big that constituency is, but it's pretty clear to me that that's an important constituency in the Republican primaries.
Yeah, I agree. And so here's another illusion. In my book, In the Door of Hope, you don't have a George Wallace-type figure who's really lighting populist fires among that group, but you're almost really looking for a new or that element of folks, the birthers, everything that you just alluded to, is really looking for a kind of populist leader to take them in a kind of George Wallace direction. And they thought they had that in Sarah Palin, right? She turned out not to be that. And to make a comparison to somebody and say they're no George Wallace, usually in most cases would be something that people would take favorably. But I think in terms of political acumen and skill, Sarah Palin did not have the skills that George Wallace did of actually building a broader coalition across the country that had a lot of those same problems with establishment America that were at the core of his message in 1964 and 1968 that I think a lot of folks that you talked about there, I think that's where a lot of their sentiment is too.
But that was a time Nixon was terrified of Wallace, of splitting the party. The time has happened since then is Ross Perot, and of course Ross Perot helped elect Bill Clinton.
Right. So it was bad for the party, absolutely. But I think right now those folks don't have somebody to hitch their wagon to. And when they're absent of that person, they're kind of just default Republicans right now whose passions aren't being channeled. They're the ones who want to be active, and it poses a real problem for a party that wants to be taken seriously, because most of the issues that you alluded to are ones that the business conservatives have no interest in touching. So I think if you're asking me again about this gulf among various constituencies within the Republican Party, it is wide. It is hard to remember a time when that gulf seemed wider. And as a historian, I'm always more comfortable looking in the past than in the future. But at this moment, it is hard for me to see which figure is going to be able to pull those various groups together.
Well, Edward France, again, presidential historian who teaches at the University of Indianapolis and the author of The Door of Hope, Republican Presidents and the First Southern Strategy. I guess to some extent, the good news in this report from the Republican National Committee released on Monday, an autopsy, if you will, on where the party stands. The report says the GOP today is the tale of two parties. One of them, the gubernatorial wing, is growing and successful. The other, the federal wing, is increasingly marginalizing itself. And unless changes are made, it will be increasingly difficult for Republicans to win another presidential election in the near future. That's a pretty blunt assessment. I think a pretty accurate one, isn't it?
I'd say it's very accurate. I think if you look at much more in-depth pieces and looking at who shapes local government. There, the Republican Party is pretty healthy. In states like the one I live in, Indiana, you really have Republican control of most of that apparatus. Majorities here in both the Assembly and the Senate, and a Republican, newly elected Republican governor, majority of congressmen who are Republican. There are a lot of states that look that way, but they don't offer enough electoral votes to add up to get your total over the top. In the Hayes days, in my book, it was always, you know, the magical number of 270. The math doesn't favor them there. And so that is a problem. And that's why I think you saw more than a few attempts or suggestions that we should do away with Electoral College coming from the mouths of Republicans this time around, because it is hard to imagine the calculus working out for Republicans to be very competitive in this current climate. They can be healthy and be very healthy on the state level. And I think also you could imagine a time in which the House remains pretty safely Republican for a pretty long period of time, just because so many of those districts are so heavily Republican. But it does not help them on the presidential ticket.
Well, just in closing, back to the social issues which are dividing them between the libertarian wing and the traditional family values wing. Senator Rob Portman, of course, coming out saying that his son is gay and his change of heart. Apparently that's been greeted in the party, but it's not going to make any difference that in terms of their policies. It seems to me hardly an accident that on the same day that this report comes out, Hillary Clinton announces that she's for same-sex marriage, which is a surefire indication she's running for president, right?
Yeah, it would certainly look that way. And, you know, it's been interesting. I can't say that I've tracked down every quotation on the Rob Portman situation. But I think to some degree, he just gets a pass on it because it's a family member. And it takes, actually, I would argue, a lot of the clout away from the statement. I mean, I think it was always the one issue that even somebody like Dick Cheney preferred not to talk about because he had a gay daughter. And I think most people, even people who weren't fans of Dick Cheney, kind of agreed not to engage him on that point. So I think he gets kind of a pass, and then Hillary Clinton coming out. I don't know why, if you're retired from the job as Secretary of State and taking time off to rest, you would issue a statement like that unless you wanted to keep yourself politically viable, correct?
Exactly. Well, Edward France, I thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure, Ian. Thanks so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Edward France, who's a presidential historian who teaches at the University of Indianapolis. He has written widely on how the American presidency has changed in the last two centuries. And his latest book is The Door of Hope, Republican Presidents and the First Southern Strategy, now out in paperback. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.